Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. We have a special episode for you today, but before that, a quick announcement. The Clinical Problem Solvers has launched a new virtual morning report series. It's called Learn Live. It is exactly what it sounds. You come, hang out with us in real time, and we go through a case all together using a virtual platform like Zoom. If you want to know more about this, click the link below in the episode. Reza, tell us more about the episode.
I'm so excited for today's episode. We've already recorded it. It's an unknown episode in the discussant dissects the case like a detective. I don't know if you dissect the case or crack a case, but regardless, she does a phenomenal job. Remember, in these episodes, the discussant is completely blinded to the case aliquot and tries to solve it in real time. We encourage you to pause the episode if you're not driving, share your own thinking, and then compare it to the discussant's response. I have the great privilege in presenting the case presenter, who is Dr. Ellie Garbod, a current chief resident at the University of Rochester Medical Center, where she completed her internship and residency in internal medicine. Following her chief year, she plans to continue her career at the University of Rochester as an academic hospitalist. Please follow her at Ellie_GarbodMD, GARBADE. Robbie, who is the discussant for tonight?
And I have the privilege of introducing Dr. Amy Zoss. She's the Associate Professor of Medicine at the Duke University School of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases and International Health. She is also the Program Director for the Internal Medicine Residency at Duke. Dr. Zoss really enjoys spending time with her husband, her two boys. She says, let's face it, they're teenagers. They're never actually home. She also enjoys spending time with her dogs and cheering on her kids. We are thrilled to have her join us. And you can also follow her on Twitter at AIMEEZAAS. All right, Ellie, take it away.
So we'll start with Aliquot 1, which is our HPI and additional history. So we have a 22-year-old, previously healthy male who presented to the emergency department with acute onset left flank pain. He was in his usual state of health until approximately 4:30 in the afternoon on the day of admission when he developed sudden onset left flank pain. This occurred shortly after he finished shoveling the driveway. The pain was sharp, initially constant, but now waxing and waning, and radiated towards his left lower quadrant and groin. After the pain started, he felt nauseous and vomited once. He denied any associated urinary symptoms, including hematuria or dysuria. He denied recent fevers, chills, night sweats, fatigue, or weight loss. His review of systems was notable for dyspnea with shoveling earlier in that day, though he attributed that to how heavy the snow was that day. He denied previous episodes of dyspnea with exertion, palpitations, or chest pain. He has a history of seasonal allergies but is otherwise healthy. He denied any history of urinary tract infections or renal calculi. He does not take any daily medications. His parents are both healthy. He denies any family history of nephrolithiasis, malignancy, autoimmune conditions, or connective tissue disorders. He was born and raised in upstate New York. He is currently enrolled in graduate school. Denies any current or previous sexual activity, and he is not in a relationship. He drinks alcohol, which is a glass of wine with dinner. Denies cigarette use, vaping, and illicit substances, including IV drug use.
Okay, so it looks like we have a young male who is otherwise healthy, at least as we've learned so far, who was doing some pretty vigorous physical activity in the winter in New York and comes in to be evaluated, it looks like, I guess in the emergency department, with the acute onset of left flank pain when he was shoveling snow. So in framing that, I have someone who sounds like he woke up to do his usual stuff and had this happen to him. And thinking of the acuity of onset of his pain, you try to frame it around, is it related to the activity that he's doing? And so something musculoskeletal while he's shoveling snow. Although the fact that it's now continuing to wax and wane and is associated with some nausea and vomiting makes me think that it's probably something more than that. And the nausea and vomiting is leading me to believe that maybe there's something more visceral about his pain. And so I think I recall from some other clinical problem solvers episodes, when someone has an acute onset of pain, you like to think in the abdomen of things either being blocked, being twisted, or being ischemic. And so those are the kind of frameworks that I'm trying to think about for why this young man might have developed this severe pain. So certainly, and then you also need to think of location of where it is. And so what organ might be involved. And so as we get a little bit of more information, we can start to think about whether this is something intestinal, something in his kidney. We're mentioning nephrolithiasis a couple of times, whether or not he has a hernia, GU, testicular torsion, or the shoveling snow is just incidental and his pain is related to something that's been going on longer.
Amy, that was incredible. And I think this is one of the reasons I love being a generalist. Like, your ability to think so broadly about this case, it almost was like an internist, an emergency medicine doctor with no boundaries. So I think this is one of the reasons I'm proud to be GIM.
So hard to ignore the acuity. And I still have to practice incorporating the time course. And I love how that was front and center in your analysis. That was a great reminder of just how crucial a data point that is. Thank you.
I really like what you mentioned about, this was a young guy, otherwise healthy, and it could be musculoskeletal pain, but I really like how you honed in on the alarm features, that it's waxing and waning, persistent. He's even had some nausea and vomiting. So I think that's really important.
Awesome. All right, Ellie, give us more, please.
All right. So Aliquot 2 will be our physical exam and initial blood work. So on exam, our patient had the following vitals. He had a temperature of 38.2 degrees Celsius, a heart rate of 105. His blood pressure was 110 over 65. He had a respiratory rate of 16 with an O2 sat of 100% on room air. Generally, he was a young man in obvious pain, but otherwise appeared well. On pulmonary exam, he had good inspiratory effort with clear lung fields throughout. His cardiac exam was notable for regular tachycardia without extra heart sounds, murmurs, or rubs. His JVP was visualized and not elevated. For his abdomen, he had normal bowel sounds and appearance of his abdomen. There was no visible trauma. His abdomen was tender to deep palpation over the left flank without palpable mass, guarding, or rebound tenderness. He has CVA tenderness on the left. For GU, his testicular exam was normal bilaterally without masses or pain on palpation. His extremities had a normal appearance. There was no edema, rashes, or abnormal lesions affecting the hands or digits. For his initial labs, his basic metabolic panel included a sodium of 142, potassium of 3.6, chloride of 103, bicarb of 20, BUN of 13, creatinine of 0.91, we do not have a baseline, glucose of 90, calcium of 9.2, FOS of 2.9, and magnesium of 1.8. His CBC included a leukocytosis to 18.9, hemoglobin of 14.2, hematocrit of 42, platelets of 152. His DIF was predominantly PMNs at 86%. His UA showed yellow and clear urine with a pH of 7, negative ketones, specific gravity of 1.016, negative for blood, negative for protein, negative for nitrites, and negative for leukocyte esterase. And that's the end of Aliquot 2.
So we're getting a more complete picture of our patient here, that although we know that he had an acute onset of what happened to him, he's actually a bit sicker than what I might have expected him to be from the first part of the story. And the things that are making me say that is he has a low-grade fever at 38.2, and he's tachycardic to 105 beats per minute. And certainly for a 22-year-old guy who's out shoveling snow, they did mention he's a graduate student, so maybe he's not typically that active. But you know, certainly that's not a normal baseline heart rate. It's hard to tell since we don't know his baseline blood pressure if 110 over 65 is a little bit hypotensive for him or not, but we'll just assume that that's his resting blood pressure. He appears to be breathing normally and has an oxygen saturation of 100% on room air. And so while I wasn't thinking based on his presentation that he had a pulmonary embolus, his oxygen saturations are actually make me feel a little bit better about that, although his tachycardia and fever could go with that. We also note that he's in pain, and his exam directs us really to his abdomen with the normal cardiopulmonary exam, as well as the normal GU exam, which can sometimes be overlooked when we see our patients. And this was an important thing to do for this young gentleman because testicular torsion was actually on my differential for a young guy coming in with that type of abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. And so we could localize on our exam that he is tender over his left flank with some CVA tenderness. Extremities are normal, and that's not really directing us anywhere. And so when we get into his labs, we can see a few abnormalities. If we first go to the CBC, if we're thinking about his fever, he certainly has an elevated white count, the rest of his CBC being normal, and he has a left shift. And so while you could potentially see that with an acute stress response, given his fever and presentation, I would have, you know, something infectious rising a bit higher on my differential here. And then when we get to his basic metabolic panel, the biggest abnormality that we all see is that his bicarb is 20. And so while we don't have an ABG, we can say that that's abnormal, and it's abnormally low. So he is likely acidemic. And while I don't enjoy doing math in my head, and we don't have his albumin, I do believe he has an anion gap. But then we get to his urinalysis, and it's actually completely normal. Maybe he's a little bit dry with that specific gravity. But if pyelonephritis, although rare in a 22-year-old man, was on our differential, it certainly drops down a bit with that normal UA.
Amy, may I ask you a question? Sure. When you get all this data, how are you able to determine where to invest your cognitive effort? Meaning what signal, what's noise? I asked that because I saw like the MAG was a little low, the FOS was a little low, and even the bicarb, like you didn't spend as much time there as you did, for example, on the white blood cell count or the physical or the tachycardia, the fever and the abdominal exam.
Yeah, well, I am an infectious diseases doctor, so maybe maybe that was it. Or maybe, you know, but I think you bring up an important point that, you know, we all are going to be drawn to certain things as we get a large set of data. And, you know, for this particular patient, we're seeing him in the emergency department. And so we're a little bit more rushed probably than we might be if we were seeing a patient on the floor, because the demands on our time are different. And so making that decision about where do you focus and then how do you go back and make sure you're not missing something that you had previously disregarded as being unimportant, but actually turns out to be important. And so, you know, as you're bringing up on here, you know, his FOSS being, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a little low. It's certainly not high. And one of the things, you know, and kind of thinking about, you know, young man with back pain. I believe he only drank like once a day or something, but you start to think about this like unusual association of Hodgkin's lymphoma with having back pain and drinking alcohol. But then like kind of going back and saying, then I'd have to say his shoveling snow is a red herring, but his FOSS is kind of low. And I just would not think necessarily someone with Hodgkin's would have a low FOSS at that point, because maybe he's having some tumor lysis and you would expect it to actually be high. So I think you have to pick out what you think is important, but always go back and make sure you didn't ignore something, you know, that, you know, like, the FOSS, who cares about the FOSS, you know, that's
right. Thank you so much, Amy.
Amy, I was really intrigued by how you were phrasing the pylo. And, you know, truth be told, I probably made an error and recalibrated it by what you said, Because here we have a young person with fever, flank pain, and a white count. And I intentionally removed the gender from my mental mapping. He's a young person with fever, flank pain, and white count. Like, how is this not Kylo in some sense? And I saw the UA and I was like, it's not Kylo because of the UA. And I picked up on something subtle that you said, which is you didn't remove Kylo. You said Kylo is certainly lower on our list because of our UA. And I thought that was such a great cognitive restructuring because I made the assumption of, oh, no whites, no Kylo. But maybe inferring a little bit from your thinking by you saying, intentionally saying it's lower and not off the DDX, that the setup of a febrile patient with flank pain and a white count is so suggestive of it that even a negative UA wouldn't completely take it off the table. Is that a fair analysis of what you did by saying lower versus off?
Yeah, I think so. Because again, you know, there's a lot of things in his clinical picture, you know, although maybe an atypical host in a non-sexually active 22-year-old male, why would he have Kylo? But we don't, you know, maybe he has, you know, something abnormal in his urinary tract we don't know about yet. But that being said, when there's a lot of pieces of your clinical history and exam that point towards a common finding, using one test as your only reason to say it's not there can sometimes lead to errors. And so I think, I haven't seen aliquot 3, obviously, but I suspect that this patient in real life would have still gotten, you know, a urine culture and is likely going to end up needing some type of abdominal imaging, whether, you know, the team starts with an ultrasound or a CT scan. It probably depends on local culture of what happens in that emergency department and what's available. But, you know, taking it completely off when you've got a febrile young guy with flank pain and tenderness.
All right, let's do some more data.
All right, so aliquot 3 is going to be our initial imaging. So we had a CT abdomen and pelvis with contrast that was obtained in the ED. I've included the key image here. And then I have some of the findings below. So the right kidney is unremarkable in appearance and demonstrates normal enhancement and no evidence of hydronephrosis. There is a striated nephrogram appearance of the left kidney with multiple hypodense areas of decreased enhancement. There is no significant hydronephrosis, and no definitive urinary tract calculi are seen. To summarize the other findings of the CT, there was no definitive pathology of the liver, gallbladder, spleen, adrenal glands, bowel loops, bladder, or abdominal aorta. There is no evidence of retroperitoneal mass or lymphadenopathy. There is no free air, and there are no suspicious osseous lesions. Lung bases were visualized and unremarkable. And that's the end of aliquot 3.
I am so glad that there was also a radiologist who read the CT and it wasn't going to be my job to do the flat out interpretation. But, you know, certainly in looking at it, when we had gone back to pre-imaging, pre-exam, you know, when someone had the acute onset of left lower quadrant pain, I had a differential that was encompassing a lot of the intra-abdominal organs and then also musculoskeletal. But, you know, with our physical exam and now our cross-sectional imaging, I don't think it would be a mistake to zone in on the fact that that striated nephrogram appearance of the left kidney is part of our money shot here as to what might be wrong with our patient. I certainly suspect he's someone who's not had imaging before. I'm going to have to assume that this finding is new. And so in looking at that, and we just see this cut, but they tell us that there's, you know, no other pathology that they see, including the absence of other masses or lymphadenopathy. So I think that's important as well. And so trying to make sense of what might be wrong with his kidney, why does it have that appearance? You know, certainly things that are going through my mind, and I would be talking to the radiologist and asking them to help think about the differential with me. But infection, particularly an emphysematous pyelonephritis, so pyelonephritis with a gas-forming organism, potentially could have an appearance like that. He's not the right host for that, as far as I can tell from what we know about him, because you like to think about that particular disease in poorly controlled diabetics, someone who this patient is not. But that would be something to think about. In addition, thinking about, you know, it's certainly odd to have emboli just to that kidney without evidence of emboli anywhere else, but keeping on a differential that this could be a vascular phenomenon as well. And then whether or not he actually has a primary disorder of his kidney that's leading to the abnormal appearance as well. Again, he's an atypical host for malignancy, a renal malignancy, but certainly something to think about.
I really love what you did there, especially when talking about, you know, the CT scan, not only what we see, but I feel like what we don't see helps us just as much as what we see in the kidney, what's going on. And I love how you talked about your differential is still broad. We've localized what organ we think is infected and is causing most of the symptoms, but we're still worried about infection, emboli, and malignancy, as you mentioned. So I think that's also important.
Yeah, and I think we can go back to the fact that we have determined that he's systemically ill, being febrile and tachycardic with these findings as well that keep the differential, you know, a bit more open.
I can't wait for aliquot 4.
You guys ready for it?
Sure.
Okay. Aliquot 4. So the patient was given a dose of IV ceftriaxone in the ED and admitted to hospital medicine. Over the first 24 hours of admission, the patient continued to fever with a Tmax of 39 degrees Celsius. Blood cultures were obtained in the ED and those were negative at 24 hours. He had some additional lab work, including an LDH of 1062. And then the next imaging was actually a transthoracic echocardiogram that was obtained. I've included some key images here. Contrast is used on the right. And then the read on the echo. So there's a negative saline bubble test, normal RV and RA. All valves were structurally normal without evidence of regurgitation or stenosis. No pericardial effusion. In the left ventricle, the LVEDP was normal. The EF was normal between 55 and 75%. There was normal LV wall motion. There is a large tissue density mass in the center of the LV cavity in the area of the papillary muscles, as in a regular shape, but roughly 2.5 by 2.8 centimeters. And that's the end of aliquot 4.
Okay, so that's not supposed to be there. I think, yeah, so we have a couple more things to go through with our patient here. And so, you know, based on the initial management of the patient, it sounds like the physicians who were seeing him went with, you know, common things being common, which is not the wrong thing to do. Bring the patient into the hospital. He's just unwell enough that you don't want to send him home saying, I'm sure this is pyelo. Here's your, you know, fluoroquinolone and, you know, you'll be well. And so they bring him in and treat him, you know, for a presumptive, you know, upper urinary tract infection. But by keeping him, they did the right thing because he doesn't do well with that initial therapy. Fevers again, doesn't have any culture data. And then we do get an LDH back, which is quite elevated at over 1,000. And so from there, I'm guessing they were thinking, you know, similarly that maybe this is emboli to the kidney for some reason, and that's why he has the striated appearance. And so a transthoracic echo was obtained. And although they found normal valves, they found this mass that's in his LV cavity, which, you know, certainly should not be there and needs to be, you know, further explored. And so putting things together now, what we have is a young guy who still came in with an acute illness, found to be febrile tachycardic with a little bit of acidosis, and had a kidney that was abnormal, whether it was initially thought to be infectious, but could have been septic or other types of emboli to that kidney, and is now found to continue to be febrile with a lot of cellular breakdown showing that LDH and a mass that appears to be the same density as the cardiac muscle. And so I think our differential now really jumps away from common things and moves to things that are much more rare. And so you start to think about, is this a primary intracardiac tumor that we're finding on echocardiogram that's actually embolized to his kidney? Is this a clot that's embolized to his kidney? And then you have to start thinking, well, why would a young kid have this, and start to invoke reasons to be hypercoagulable for him to have an intracardiac thrombus and then throw that to his kidney. So I feel like that's more of a stretch, and I would be concerned that this was something that was relatively rare, which would be some type of intracardiac tumor. Probably go to look up, aside from a cardiac, you know, rhabdomyoma, what other things could this be? You know, he's young, lymphoma can present from anywhere. So something to think about. This mass isn't lining the endocardium, and he wasn't eosinophilic. Sometimes you can see something odd with a hypereosinophilic syndrome, but this just doesn't fit. So I would be extraordinarily concerned about what's in his heart there. Think that some of it went to his kidney and need to be looking into that.
Like I said, we want to turn this into a conversation. If this were happening in real life, I would just be sitting and be like, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. It's such a crisp analysis of why cardiac tumor is being prioritized. And I gotta say, I'm probably gonna have to listen to that multiple times to be able to like really comprehend that. But thank you so much. That was really quite impressive.
And two other things I want to highlight that I really appreciated from your discussion so far, Amy. One was calling the radiologist. Like, I know we're doing this fun game here, but how much critical information do we get when you actually speak to a radiologist? Do you think there's a clot or not? And they'll tell you. And the second thing I love that you did is you're like, there's an intracardiac mass. You gave a differential diagnosis for that. Then you said, you know, I'm concerned for a tumor, but I don't have the longest DDX for a tumor. In fact, Amy, you said one more diagnosis than I knew in the heart, meaning I knew nothing. So just knowing that a mass can be a tumor is enough to get your wheel spinning to look for the differential diagnosis. I think that's very, very important.
Oh, yeah. I'm on the edge of my couch, not my seat.
Come on, Ellie. Don't go home. No, like
okay. If the patient were at Duke, he'd be getting a cardiac MRI, like, before we even flip to the next
page. I feel like people often say ask and you shall receive, but I guess ask and you shall receive. Aliquot 5 is a cardiac MRI.
Oh my gosh.
I've included the key image here. So the key findings, there is a large left ventricular mass which arises from the basal septum and involves much of the mid cavity. The mass enhances and does so uniformly differently than the myocardium. It is adherent to the wall. There are additional implants along the infralateral wall and in the LV apex. There are no other masses noted throughout the thorax, and there is no lymphadenopathy.
Well, I can definitely say I've never quite seen anything like this image, but certainly probably explains the dyspnea that he had while he was shoveling snow. And it's pretty remarkable that, you know, his first symptoms from what is clearly, a very abnormal finding on his cardiac MRI was flank pain, because I think I feel more confident putting this together. And, you know, when I think of differential diagnoses and we do this in report, I often say, like, try to come up with several stories that explain what might happen to the patient, because that's a little bit easier than coming up with a list. And so in putting the story together, we have a young guy who was feeling pretty good, maybe got a bit more short of breath than he thought he should for shoveling snow, but then had the acute onset of flank pain that caused him to come to the emergency department. And based on a series of tests that were obtained that we've talked about, we are now coming in to talk to him about our concern that he has a primary intracardiac malignancy, which sarcoma would be still highest on my differential, although lymphoma is something to think about, and maybe there's several other rare things that I would have to look up that we think embolize to his kidney, which is actually why he came to medical attention right now. And I think I also feel more confident saying that this is primary intracardiac because of the rest of the imaging. He doesn't have associated lymphadenopathy. He doesn't have, you know, any other pathology that we found except this, and then what we think is a piece of this that went to his kidney.
Brilliant. Ellie, if Lindsay, you don't have any question, I'm really curious to see what happens.
So I didn't mention this before, but the next aliquot will reveal the diagnosis. So I don't know if you guys are supposed to put your nickel down, but
I'm behind Amy on this one.
Oh my god! Oh my god! 100% die. I mean,
yeah. Sorry. You know, sounds good.
I feel so nervous to do this. I was so excited and so nervous, and then I listened to you guys yesterday for the most recent one, and it was a case of disseminated histo, and I was like, oh my god, they used up their ID case before I come on. Like, So I am kind of, you know, very, very excited to hear what the final diagnosis is as well.
Okay, so aliquot 6. So blood cultures remained negative at 5 days. Flow cytometry was obtained, and that was negative. He underwent a high-risk left ventricular biopsy with the use of embolic protection devices in the carotid arteries, and pathology resulted as a synovial sarcoma. Just to kind of go through the rest of his course, he was initially treated with 4 cycles of chemotherapy, including ifosfamide, doxorubicin, and dexpramazoxane. His treatment was complicated by emergence of a new calf nodule with biopsy consistent with metastatic disease. Hazopinib was added to the 4 additional cycles of chemotherapy. He received radiation to the calf and heart, and his actual latest CT scans and cardiac MRI 2 years later show no clinical evidence of disease, which is quite an impressive outcome for this patient.
That's amazing. Yeah. So do they think that, so I had sarcoma on my differential, but synovial sarcoma, I will admit, was not on my differential. So you guys are going to have to teach me about that. Is that something that's thought to arise from the endocardium?
So the malignant cell is a synovial cell. It's actually biphasic, so there's also some spindle cells, but it's more of an undifferentiated sarcoma, so not arising from the endocardium itself.
Yeah, Ellie, maybe you can tell us, maybe you can go through the learning and teaching points, and then we'll take a moment to reflect afterwards. But we're all itching to know a little bit more about this diagnosis.
Sure. So I have a lot of teaching points, mostly because I love this case. So this was a case I saw 2 years ago when I was a teaching resident. So not even the senior resident, just a bonus resident that got to hang out with the team and go through cases with them. And this case has so many great teaching points from both a clinical reasoning standpoint, but also just pathology and something that I had never heard of before this case. So just to talk through some of the clinical reasoning that went on behind the actual care of this patient. So I did not include the actual, the impression and the read from the CT abdomen and pelvis. And the read was actually striated nephrogram appearance consistent with pyelonephritis. So this guy had a lot of diagnostic momentum coming out of the ED. He was given ceftriaxone. He had a CT read of pyelonephritis. So really the admitting team that I was working with spent a lot of time kind of taking the history again and focusing in on the tempo, which you guys already all identified as being so important in this case. And really they focused in on kind of the hyperacuity of the symptoms. And Amy, exactly like you said, they focused in on, you know, whether this could be a vascular phenomenon or structural, including obstruction and perforation. And that is kind of what pushed them to do the more vascular workup and go for the echocardiogram. He actually did defervesce after 24 hours, so I think without doing that, this cardiac mass could have been missed. We also talked to radiology a lot for this case, mostly because that read did say it was consistent with pyelonephritis. And when we looked at that CAT scan, all I saw were infarcts. And that was probably just me not knowing all the ways that pyelonephritis can look on a CAT scan. So we asked the radiologist to take us through and explain why the CT looked like pylo to them instead of renal infarcts. And one of the teaching points that came out of that is there's actually something called a cortical rim sign, which is helpful for distinguishing pyelonephritis from renal infarcts. So both renal infarcts and pyelonephritis can have a striated nephrogram appearance, but with renal infarcts, you can sometimes see a cortical rim, which is this thin rim of capsular enhancement right at the edge of the kidney. And this happens because the perfusion to the distal most part of the kidney towards the capsule is actually supplied by a really proximal branch of the renal artery. So that's often not disrupted when it's a renal infarct. This isn't seen consistently in the studies I was looking at. Was about 50% of renal infarcts, you can see this finding. They did not see it on this patient's CT, which is part of the reason why they were thinking more of a pyelonephritis. He also did not have kind of the perinephric inflammation and stranding you might suspect with pylo. And then to get into synovial sarcoma, because that was a new one for me too, once we saw that echo and we're thinking about cardiac tumors, all of us had a DDX of like 1 to 2, right? So we thought of sarcomas in general, maybe. But really, what we were more thinking about was myxoma, and that's kind of where our differential left off. So we spent a lot of time looking up cardiac tumors. And just to talk through them generally, metastatic involvement is so much more common than primary cardiac tumors. So when you see tumors involving the heart, usually you're looking for metastatic disease from elsewhere. Of primary cardiac tumors, benign etiologies are much more common than malignant. So benign are over 75% of cardiac tumors. The most common one being the benign myxoma that we kind of all think about and that I learned about in med school. When they are malignant for the primary cardiac tumors, sarcomas are the most common, but then again, there's several subtypes. Synovial sarcoma is pretty much case report only, and it's kind of at the bottom of the list of the sarcomas, so really rare even within that rare type of cancer. He does fit the age group, so usually you'll see synovial sarcomas present in young males, usually in the 20s or 30s, but often presents in their extremity, kind of like a typical soft tissue sarcoma. When you do see cardiac synovial sarcomas, they typically present in the pericardium, and then less commonly in the right atrium, so a left ventricular synovial sarcoma is exceptionally rare. The treatment for this is surgical resection if possible, though that's often hard depending upon where in the heart it involves, plus chemo and radiation. There also is consideration of heart transplants when patients have these tumors, and that was discussed for our patient. He did not have surgical resection because of the involvement in the left ventricle as well as the septum, so there was concern for how high risk that would be.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely learned a lot about synovial sarcomas, which is very, very new to me at this point. But I think one of the things that, you know, I'll take away from this also is his how well the patient happened to do with such a rare and, you know, serious diagnosis. And then even going back to his physical exam, where his cardiac exam was normal. And mm-hmm. So, you know, you were saying like, yes, we, you know, the left atrial myxoma, you know, I think, you know, you get to see one once or twice in your life, and, you know, you pretend like you hear this tumor plop, you know, or whatnot. But for this mass that was fixed, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect to hear anything different on his exam than, you know, he was just tachycardic.
I just wanted to thank Ellie and Lindsay. This case was phenomenal, and what a great outcome for the patient. Amy, the discussion was superb. Like, you know, I refer to you as a generalist because I really don't know what your expertise is in based on your discussion. That was phenomenal. Thank you.
Well, that's like the highest compliment from a generalist. Well, ID docs, we tend to think of ourselves as at least people who, you know, have to think of the whole patient all the time. And that's why we like our profession. But still, from a true generalist, that's a very high compliment. So thank you so much.
I also want to throw in my thanks to Ellie and Lindsay. But in addition to what Reza said, also commend you for not choosing an ID case for Amy, because we probably would have been done like 30 minutes ago if that were the case. So I'm really glad that we got to see her reasoning all the way until the cardiac mass through the sarcoma. So thank you all. This was a delight.
That's a wrap, folks.